Bruin's right, due process rights under the Fifth Amendment, as interpreted by the Supreme Court in Turner v. Rogers. To the extent that the facts in Turner v. Rogers are different from the facts in the instant case, all the differences argue even more strongly in favor of a finding that there was a due process violation.
You agree that claim was not preserved below?
No, I do not agree that that claim was not reserved below, Your Honor. And this becomes somewhat circular. And the point that I will make throughout this argument, oh, and I'm sorry, I forgot to say I've asked to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Please excuse me. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is I submit that this is a fabric where you can't remove any of the threads. She did not give him counsel. She did not advise him of his right to appeal. He is a layperson. So he did not know he had a right to appeal. So to then say that he waived the issue of deprivation of counsel because he was not informed of his right to appeal just gets us back in a loop of he didn't know about it because he didn't have a lawyer, which is why I cited the Rodriguez
case. He appealed from the September 2012 order.
Yes.
Did he have a lawyer then?
No, he had met with Mr.
No, but he didn't have a lawyer in that.
No, he did not have a lawyer. He
had did met, the court tell him he could appeal from that order?
No.
You argued, Ms. Stein, that she didn't alert him to the fact that he might have a right to counsel. She did not give him counsel. But isn't that latter, the premise of that latter ostensible error is not established in the record. Yes, she didn't engage in a colloquy, but it's still an open question on this record, unlike in Turner versus Rogers or the other cases that upon which you rely, it's an open question whether, in fact, he was unable to afford counsel, isn't it?
I think it is not clearly established on the factual record. I agree with that, Your Honor. But it wasn't that he was interviewed and found not eligible for appointed counsel and then told he needed to retain his own. There was no discussion at all. And, of course, in 2011, when she called the federal defender in, there was no further inquiry. There was nothing that had changed factually.
I understand that that's your claim, but the error then is in the court not engaging in the appropriate colloquy.
Yes.
And so if that were, in fact, a violation of Mr. Gwynn's due process rights, isn't the proper remedy to remand for him to establish an inability to afford counsel as of what, 2007? April 2007?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because there was no waiver at all. So to conduct the hearing at all without counsel when he had not waived is the due process violation. If the only issue were the failure to appoint, then I would agree with Your Honor.
But it's not clear whether he actually had a right. He may have had a right in the circumstances of the case to the colloquy, but it's not clear that the result of that is he hasn't put forward an affidavit saying, I can't afford counsel. Prosecution hasn't had a chance to test the assertion whether he can afford counsel or not. So would you, are you seeking a remedy that would allow a remand for him to establish that as of 2007 he was unable to afford counsel? Is that a remedy that you're not seeking?
Well, that certainly isn't our first choice, Your Honor. I'm not saying that we would not accept that remedy if that were the only one that the court were willing to grant. But, excuse me. But I am saying that he also wasn't given any time to retain his own counsel. He was brought in custody, and a hearing is just held immediately. There was no colloquy about whether he wanted to waive. There was no issue about whether there would be a continuance to see if he could retain someone locally if he had the ability. He was brought in custody. And even though the court had said at the April status hearing that they would discuss those issues if she brought him back, they never did. And he certainly didn't waive. And the government's argument seems to be that because he didn't bring it up himself, that somehow that was a forfeiture of his right. But I think the law is very clear that you cannot forfeit the right. You can only waive it. And the Carnley case says that...
Well, hang on. I think you can only... The law you're talking to talks about someone who has at least asserted indigency, right? Have they ever said that anyone walks in court and without even claiming indigency in a civil case, they have a right to a colloquy? What case?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think that saying in a civil case is asking the question too broadly. Turner v. Rogers talked specifically about civil contempt and said what must be weighed is what's at stake for the defendant, how many lawyers or whether there are any lawyers on the other
side. Nothing in that case said there was any duty to engage in a colloquy. He asserted his own indigency in that case.
Well,
I'm trying to figure out in what case in the civil arena contempt anywhere other than juvenile, you know, juvenile delinquency, right?
But there is no due process right to counsel in a civil case at all, whereas Turner says there is one when your liberty is at stake under certain circumstances. It is not an automatic right. It is a right, to a due process right, not a Sixth Amendment mm-hmm. right. But that is why it is not comparable to other civil cases, Your Honor, because
Turner,
there's no due
dealt with indigency. And I think what you're collapsing two things, I think. And that is, first, you're assuming the right is there's a right to indigence, to certain protections when you're indigent. Then there is drawn from that a right to have the court sui sponte on its own inquire whether you're indigent. And so what I'm asking is just that predicate question: what authority do you have that says a court must, outside a criminal case, sui sponte, inquire into indigency?
I'm not claiming that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is there must be some discussion about counsel. Do you have counsel? Can you get your own counsel? Or does the court, or are you asking the court to appoint and then conduct? If the answer is yes, I'd like the court to appoint, then respond to that with what
again,
we'll have.
And where is that in a civil context?
I think that's in Turner v. Rogers, Your Honor. I think that's in Turner v. Rogers. The due process entitles you to a lawyer. I'm not trying to deflect the conversation. Mm-hmm. I did want to make a further response to the question you asked before about not being advised of his right to appeal, but I'm mm-hmm. not trying to finish
sure.
this topic.
No, go ahead.
I just want to say, Your Honor, that's why I cited the Rodriguez case in my reply brief, because when there is a right to appeal and one was not advised of it, the proper remedy is to vacate the previous judgment, reimpose it so that a new appeal period runs. That, of course, never happened, and of course...
That's only, again, been done via habeas for criminal cases, correct?
Pardon me?
That's only been done via habeas for criminal cases.
Well, the Rodriguez case certainly arose in that situation.
But, I mean, it's the only place I've been able to find that.
Yes, Your Honor, but I just think this becomes circular. He didn't have a lawyer, and he is now being told, if that is the position, that he cannot attack that he didn't have a lawyer because he didn't know about the legal steps to take that only a lawyer would know
Let me ask an even more basic question. Do we have jurisdiction to review any errors that allegedly occurred in the 2007 proceeding?
Yes, I believe you do, Your Honor, both under the principle I just stated, under an equitable principle, because this was an equitable proceeding, and also because this was a continuing civil contempt that was reasserted. It wasn't a new contempt. The judge's order in 2012 was the contempt remains in effect. So
but it
she,
no longer remains in effect.
No, but that's only because the government moved her to vacate
Does
it.
Does that moot it?
No, I don't believe that it does, Your Honor.
And that depends on your view that your client is entitled to relief in terms of some or full crediting of the time he served
yes.
on contempt because of what you characterize as a deprivation of the right to counsel. I think just following up on Judge Millett's question, we're trying to get at what are the procedural aspects? Like, does the right to counsel, where it attaches under Turner versus Rogers and the Court of Appeals cases, in that line of cases, does the right to counsel, once it attaches, operate like the right to counsel in a criminal case? Is it? Do we follow the CJA process? Do we go by the 18 U.S.C. 3006 procedures or not? And where do we look?
Turner v. Rogers is new enough that I have not found law explicating all of that.
Well, there was a whole line of cases, much of which survives Turner. You know, the Court of Appeals cases leading up to Turner recognizing this right.
Yes, so I'm sorry. If Your Honor could ask me the question again.
Well, just what's your position on assuming there is a right to counsel under Turner, how does it operate? What are the burdens? Whose burden is it to seek counsel? Whose burden is it to show that there's a lack of funds such that the person is entitled to counsel? Because you're assuming that your client was entitled to counsel in 2007, but as you know, this record in the case does not show an inability to pay.
Well, I think that the burden is on the court to address the issue of counsel. I agree with Your Honor that the defendant has to make some showing of indigency. Now, of course, normally in the CJA context, that's done just by answering questions and signing a piece of paper saying it's true. The court might have required more in this case because of the history of the case. But certainly, Turner v. Rogers is not consistent with the idea that by the defendants not aggressively reasserting a right to counsel repeatedly, that he has lost the right to counsel.
I think our question is, what's your authority for that? And then what flows? Assuming we agreed with you, which you have yet to decide, but assuming we agreed with you that there is a right to counsel under Turner in a situation like this, it's not simple, and it's not necessarily as simple as your brief projects. What flows from that? If there's a right to counsel, but he didn't assert it, or there's a right to counsel, the judge didn't notify him of it, but if she had, it would have been found that he wasn't entitled to it. Well, so in the cases in which it was his obligation to assert and he didn't assert it, that's a different result from the one you're seeking. Well, in a case in which the judge had an obligation to notify him, and in the end, he wasn't entitled to it, that would also lead to a different result. So how do we post hoc unravel that?
My answer to that, Your Honor, is that it is, because it is a due process right, that all the constitutional cases are consistent, that you cannot forfeit a constitutional right, that it is not incumbent, was not incumbent on him to keep saying, I want a lawyer, I want a lawyer. That the court cannot proceed to the hearing without saying, do you plan to be represented?
Okay, assuming he had a constitutional right to have her engage in the colloquy, and that right was deprived, but only that right, what's the cure for that now?
I think the cure for that now is to find that the contempt proceeding was flawed and that it has to be vacated back to the date that it was imposed with his getting credit against his criminal sentence.
Or we have to look at what harm flowed from that if he, in fact, could afford counsel. That colloquy was given in an abundance of caution, and he has no underlying Turner right to counsel. Isn't that the case?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that Turner just talks about appointed counsel. Turner talks about a due process right to counsel, so that if he didn't qualify for CJA, then the court should have said, well, how long do you need to get your own lawyer, and given him a reasonable continuance to come back with counsel. What Turner did not allow her to do was what she did, which is simply to conduct a substantive hearing without ever addressing the issue of counsel. We also have the issue of what I have submitted in my brief, and I see I'm down to only 2 minutes, was the failure to follow the statutory scheme, which I think preempts the inherent civil contempt power in this case, and I've addressed that in my brief, as well as his repeated efforts to try to show a present inability to pay. And he was also frustrated in that by no counsel, because no matter how much evidence he gave the court, it was always, it's not enough. And the Rylander case talks about a burden of production, not about a burden of persuasion. And I submit that he met his burden of production by providing all the statements.
Can I clarify one thing? In 2007, in September 2007, was he indigent and unable to read, as a matter of fact?
It is my understanding that he was, Your Honor. Of course,
did
I cannot.
Did he not, in the next month or two, send a check to a national, NLPA or something like that, a lawyer association?
That was not from him, Your Honor. That was from family.
Okay, but he had access to resources.
Well,
I just want to make sure you're representing, as a matter of fact.
I have been paid by his extended family. I don't think that establishes that he has resources.
I'm just asking you if you can represent, as a matter of fact, before this court, that he was indigent and unable to afford counsel in 2007.
The only reason that I am hesitant, Your Honor, is I have not seen all his financial records, so I do not want to say something that I do not have a sufficient basis. I have been informed by my client and by his immediate family that that is the case, but I certainly am not in a position to prove that. And I submit that's a second important error that the judge made, was by not holding an evidentiary hearing when he didn't meet his burden of production and show these outlays of fund and say, I could not control my wife's accounts, that there should have been an evidentiary hearing where he was allowed to establish those things, and that the court just repeatedly refused to allow him to show a present inability to pay, saying your ability to pay was found in 2005, and we are not reopening that issue. And that also was a deprivation of his rights.
He had represented, you don't dispute that he had represented to the court earlier in 2007 that he did have the ability to pay the at least $600,000 judgment?
Well, no. He had said that he would pay it, Your Honor, but then...
But he had the ability to pay it.
No. What he meant by that, and he said that afterwards, was that he was going to send that fictitious negotiable instrument. He didn't say he had actual funds. It was, oh, yeah, I'll be taking care of it. I can do that. And then he sent that ridiculous fictitious instrument to the court and explained afterwards, when the judge brought it up, you told me you could pay. That's what I meant. I was going to send you that fictitious instrument, that worthless piece of paper that I said was $2.5 million.
If I could just ask one more question, I want to clarify the grounds on which you think we have jurisdiction over the 2007 contempt order. That was a final judgment of contempt and appealable in its own right, correct?
I believe so, yes.
It was. And so on what basis do we say that you have the ability in 2012 to appeal and bring forward a judgment that appeal time has long since run on? It was final appealable judgment in 2007. When have we ever allowed that? Do you have a case that allows
no,
that?
No, I do not have it. The facts of this case are so unusual, Your Honor, that I do not have a case exactly on point. I've answered that question the best I can, that it was a continuing contempt, and that because he had no counsel and was not advised of his right to appeal, that this was apparently finally somebody told him about it at some point.
I have just a related question. Is there, and if Turner establishes in certain circumstances or suggests in certain circumstances that there may be a right to counsel in a civil case where somebody's facing time, and that in the preceding court of appeals cases, that to the extent that Turner didn't reverse them, establish that. Is there a right to counsel on an appeal from a civil contempt? And are there any cases on that? Because if there isn't, your harm that infects the failure to appeal in 2007 doesn't really follow.
I cannot cite a case to you, Your Honor. I believe that there is such a right, but I'm sorry. I'm not prepared with the precedent directly on point on that. I think that necessarily flows from the due process argument. She actually asked him if he wanted to be locked up for the rest of his natural life. The Constitution does not allow that kind of action with an unrepresented person. That's what Turner says. I mean, Turner, he was facing much less time. I know the court remanded in Turner saying there's no automatic line, but they laid out the factors, and all the factors that they laid out militate strongly in favor of having found that he had such a right in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Stein.
Good morning. May it please the court. Liza Collery on behalf of the United States. As I see the matter and from the questions that were asked this morning, there seem to me to be three fundamental questions relating to this right to counsel claim. There's the procedural question about whether Gowin waived any such claim by never raising it at any time during the 6 years of proceedings in the district court. Then there's the question of whether he has a right to counsel in this 2007 civil contempt proceeding at all. And then there's the question that Judge Pillard was raising, if he had a right to counsel, what kind of procedures were needed in order
to... Well, can I ask a fourth question?
Yes.
And that is the one predicate to all three, and that is, do we have jurisdiction to look at any errors that happened in the 2007 proceeding, or are we only looking at the 2012 proceeding?
I think the court has jurisdiction only to the extent that it finds that the 2007 proceeding is inextricably intertwined.
Right, so what is your position on that?
Do you think it is not?
Okay, so your position is that we don't have jurisdiction to review errors in the 2007
That's correct.
Case, or the 2008 if you count either one of those.
That's correct.
And why is it not inextricably intertwined in the way Salazar referenced?
Well, I think that gets into some of these other merits other questions about the merits of the right to counsel claim.
Well, I mean, does it? I mean, what was inextricably intertwined there was that you had, the reference was to a prior interlocutory order, and that's a traditional appellate standard that you can, that, you know, in one an appeal can bring forward a prior interlocutory appeal or order, but my sense is that the 2007 one, and I think was conceded, was not an interlocutory order. It was a final appealable order. So I guess I'm asking whether we have to look at other things to determine that it wasn't inextricably intertwined.
Your Honor, the only argument, and I'm not presenting it, the only argument that could be made was if this was a hapless, indigent defendant who was denied any assistance of counsel throughout the six-year period and was essentially locked up without access to any resources and denied.
Well, that sounds like the argument that they would make. I'm asking you what the United States position is, because Salazar itself referred only to inextricably intertwined previously interlocutory orders, and this was not. So I'd really, I guess, rather hear your argument on, so that I hear both sides of this, on whether we have jurisdiction. It's a really important question for me, which contempt order we're reviewing.
Your Honor, I would say that the court does not have jurisdiction.
And that's because it's not inextricably intertwined, just because
what happened in 2012 was simply a determination that as of that date, Mr. Gwynn, who had finally become interested in his civil contempt proceedings in February of 2012 and had made some unsuccessful attempts to provide the necessary financial information, had not met his burden. And that determination is not inextricably intertwined. Has not met his burden of showing that he could not comply.
Could not afford counsel or could not comply with the contempt?
No, there was never any discussion about counsel at any point in the district court. And that's because Mr. Gwynn did not want counsel at any point in time. He didn't want counsel in 2007, during which period of time he was continuing to spend the money that the judgment in his criminal case.
You say he didn't want counsel, but the appellant's entire claim is that there was a burden on the court under Turner to inquire. And in fact, the judge seemed to recognize that in April when she said, if we get down to contempt, and we're going to have to talk about it, and then drops the ball in the actual contempt hearing, has no colloquy. This is a judge who knows how to do this colloquy, has no colloquy with
it. But I don't think she dropped the ball at all. I think what she said in April 2007, what she clearly said is, if we get to civil contempt, if you want an attorney, you can hire one, or I'll provide one.
And you think that counts? That discharges whatever burden the district judge might have under Turner or the cases establishing a right to counsel?
There was no burden under Turner. Turner is a case that deals with an indigent, don't want to use the term defendant, but an indigent civil contemptor who wants to raise a claim that he has no assets. That could hardly be further from this case. What we have here, what happened in 2007 is the judge brought him in after he didn't pay and said, what's going to happen here? Are you going to pay? He said, I have assets sufficient to pay not only the $650,000, but the full $2.5 million. I have those assets. I'm going to pay. It's just a matter of dealing with my business associates. And he was not referring at that time to the bogus International Bill of Exchange. He talked to her about electronic transfers, checks,
right.
Suitcases full of.
Right.
So he
right.
said, I can pay and I will pay. So he had no right to counsel. Even if Turner had created a right to counsel, which it didn't, it would be strictly related to an indigent defendant who wants to raise a claim that he cannot pay. And here what we had was a defendant who said, I can pay, I will pay, I intend to pay.
Your view is that if somebody comes into court facing potential contempt and has no ability to pay a lawyer, if that person doesn't affirmatively ask for a lawyer, there is no violation. Somebody comes in unrepresented, and I know it's not your position, but assume that we read Turner and the whole line of cases in which it's embedded to say there is a right to counsel when you're facing incarceration for civil contempt. If there were a right, nonetheless, there's no burden on the court to give any kind of colloquy. It's up to the contemnor, the potential contemnor, to ask. Is that your position?
If there's a court that provides counsel to an indigent contemnor, then there may be a burden on the court to say, by the way, if you're indigent, I'll provide you with a lawyer, if that contemnor intends to raise a defense that he can't afford to pay. But here, the judge told Mr. Gwynn that she would provide him with a lawyer, and he's not indigent, and he didn't intend to raise a defense that he wasn't able to pay.
I don't think it's clear in the record at all what his resources are. Why? I mean, if he's under a court-ordered obligation stemming from the criminal case to pay every asset that the court has been able to identify as restitution and fines, why does that not raise a presumption that he cannot afford counsel? There must be
because
many cases on that kind of situation.
The record wasn't clear what his assets were. He had provided a financial affidavit that identified some assets. The district court didn't know whether that was the entire universe of the assets that he had, but she required him to turn some of those assets over for restitution. He then comes into court in 2007 and says, I have the ability to pay the full $2.5 million. Do you want cash? Do you want an electronic transfer? I can pay. Under those circumstances, I think it would be unnecessary to impose on a district court a burden to ask the defendant whether he's indigent and would like counsel appointed. But in this case, the judge offered him counsel anyway.
In April, she said, we'll have to talk about it. And then in September, there was no discussion. Your position is that it carries over.
She didn't say we'll have to talk about it in September. She said we'll have to talk about it. And then later in the same hearing, they talked about it. So she brought it up and said, this is a problem. We're going to have to talk about counsel. And then later in the same hearing, she said, okay, let's talk about counsel. If this goes to civil contempt and you want an attorney, you can hire your own or I will appoint one. None of that was necessary because he didn't claim to be indigent. And it probably wasn't necessarily under Turner, even if he had claimed to be indigent. But she did offer him counsel.
What's the law in a, just to simplify, because there's so many overlapping issues in this case, in a criminal case, a defendant is ordered to pay $2 million. The defendant is known only to have $40,000 in an account. The judge says, pay all of that, and then every other penny that you earn, you also have to pay to us. And then there's contempt proceedings flowing from that. Is there a right to counsel based on inability to pay? Because almost structured into the situation is an inability to pay. That must come up a lot.
It might depend on the nature of the proceeding. That is,
the following
is it a probation?
Assuming the following proceeding is a proceeding for contempt and facing incarceration, and assuming, as I know is not your position, that there is a right to counsel under Turner. If there were a right to counsel, I'm asking about how it gets implemented, when there's a burden on who to raise it.
So the defendant has a criminal conviction and he has a fine.
And he has a fine that's bigger than any amount of resources he has.
And he hasn't paid the fine.
It's tapped out, and then he's coming in for contempt.
And there's a civil contempt proceeding.
Right.
And your question is?
When he comes into court with no lawyer, and the court has already said, every bit of money you have, you owe us, is there any burden on the court to do anything?
In terms of the
kind of colloquy that the court would engage in under 3006?
Under Turner, he's either entitled to an attorney at that point, if he's indigent, and he proves that he's indigent. He's either entitled.
So you're saying he has to come forward and prove. He walks into court, he says, he learns this from having read Turner?
Well, the burden's on the defendant to establish his indigency.
Right, but isn't the burden on the court, at least if the model of how CJA and lawyers operate in the criminal side, and that's part of what I'm asking, is does that apply where there's a right to counsel under Turner? In that model, the court says, and there's a whole colloquy, if you look at the United States District Court desk book, it says, and indeed it says if it's a civil contempt case, you do this kind of colloquy. Is it your position that that is not?
Well, it would depend under Turner whether there were alternative procedures. He might not even have a right to counsel under Turner.
My premise was assuming that he did. But if there are no alternative procedures.
So assuming that an indigent defendant has a right to counsel, does the judge need to inform, under statutory right, some other right, does the judge need to inform him that if he's indigent, there's a procedure that he can go through?
Probably, possibly.
I don't see that it has anything to do with this case where the defendant was
what
told.
I think is, does it make a difference here whether we're dealing with waiver or forfeiture?
I think if he had a right to counsel, then you get to the third question, which is how could he waive or forfeit that right. What happens then if he has a right to counsel? I think the record is clear here that he didn't have a right to counsel because he never claimed that he was indigent. But let's assume, arguendo, that he had some right to counsel. Then we get to a question that Judge Millett asked about, what are the procedures that you would need to have?
Well, I guess I think what makes it unusual in this context is that the two inquiries, ability to pay and indigency, are obviously closely similar.
That's right.
And I'm, at least as I read the September 2007 contempt order, there had to be a determination of willful failure to pay, and embedded in that is a determination that one has. It can't be willful if you don't have the capacity to pay. My question is, one, do you read the September 2007 order as involving a determination that he had the capacity but chose not to pay the judgment? And two, if so, is that a factual finding to which we would owe clear error review or a legal question?
I do read it as saying that. And I would say that it's a factual finding, reviewed for clear error, and that it was not clearly erroneous based on the record that was before the district court, where you had a defendant who had come before her and said, "I had $2.5 million that I can use to pay. How do you want it? Do you want a check? Do you want an electronic transfer?"
Based
on his representation that he could pay, she was certainly entitled.
But in turn,
to include
but in turn, yeah, the one, I mean. I think the reality, maybe the Turner just doesn't go this far, and it's now our job to start analyzing that question. But in Turner, at least when I looked at, I only looked at the background and the opinion. I didn't look deeper in the briefs or anything. I didn't at least see him asserting indigency affirmatively in that case.
He went before the judge, and he gave a little speech that was only partially coherent, but that suggested that he was a drug addict, that he had been incarcerated, that his circumstances didn't allow him to pay, and that he was asking for the mercy of the court.
No, but did he say, and so for the same reason that in inserting that, he would have identified his indigency for purposes of the counsel right as well. It's just that you tend to do the same thing. It just gets circular because the protection in part is for the court to explain to someone their right to show an ability to pay. So it becomes very difficult in this context to figure out where the circle starts.
He raised his indigency inartfully, but he raised it.
Okay.
He went before the court and explained his circumstances.
Is that in, where would I find that?
I think the colloquy is in the Supreme Court's decision, but if not, it's in
it has a little bit where he talks about drugs and everything, you're using all this money on drugs. That's the one you're referring
right,
to?
Right, but the Solicitor General's brief in that case is very helpful, and it is it's the document on which the Turner decision really chiefly relied. So the colloquy is in that brief, if not.
And can I ask I'm sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
So you mentioned that he said he had plenty of money in April. And then in September, the judge had no obligation to inform him of any right to counsel that he might have. And if Turner applies, your position is Turner doesn't give him a right to counsel, and that's because
Turner talks about rights to court-appointed counsel.
Right.
He didn't have a right to court-appointed counsel because he wasn't indigent.
Wasn't unable to pay.
He was.
What about once in October, he writes to her and says, "All that bluster about the millions was that I thought I could pull the wool over your eyes and defraud you too, and now that it's clear that I can't, actually the truth is I'm flat broke."
Right.
Anything arise from that? Here's somebody who's being held in prison on contempt. No obligation on her part to inquire whether he needs counsel because he has no ability to pay and he's in prison?
Well, she does at that point in time explain to him how he needs to go about paying. And I think under Turner that's probably all that was required.
Because that's alternative procedure?
Yes. She at that point explained to him what he needed to do to make his claim and set that out. And what happened then was that he just completely dropped the ball.
Doesn't Turner say that one needs both the circumstance that the state is not on the other side and alternative procedures to support the majority result in that case? I mean, this is very different from Turner.
I would say that the state being on the other side had very little to do with the case after 2007, when it's just a matter of Gwynne writing to the judge. But I agree that Turner doesn't deal with situation where the government's representative just doesn't talk about that. But at that point,
well, the prior judge cases did, uniformly say court of appeals cases in the conflict was that some states didn't, that led to the Supreme Court review in turn. The court of appeals cases uniformly said, facing prison time on civil contempt, you get a lawyer.
Those cases were wrong, Judge Pillar.
Well, no, and they weren't overturned by Turner to the extent that Turner dealt with a specific circumstance where it wasn't the state on the other side and where there were alternative procedures, meaning a whole courthouse set of alternative procedures. Here we're in an adversary hearing where the United States government is on the other side and the man spends years in prison.
Well, there was we're talking, I think, now about the post-2007 time frame. And there was no adversary hearing at that point. There was just the defendant writing to the judge and saying, I told you I could pay. Now I'm telling you something different. And at that point, she did everything that could be expected of her, which is that she told him that failure to pay is a defense and explained to him how to go about proving that defense. And furthermore, after that, in 2009, there was a colloquy between the judge and Mr. Gwynn about whether he wanted counsel. And he affirmatively said he did not want counsel. He wrote in his habeas corpus petition that no corporate attorneys needed to be appointed. And at that point, she wrote him back saying, I'm inclined to appoint counsel, but I hear you saying that you're not going to accept counsel. Yes. So yeah. To the extent that we're talking about the post-2007 time frame, she once again reiterated her offer to provide him with counsel.
I just had a distinct procedural question, and that is when someone has funds originally and deliberately dissipates them, so they get to the point where, because there is actually no factual ability to pay, and so at some point you have to drop the civil contempt, at least as you did, I think you concluded here. Does the United States have resources to go after those people when they're released from jail to try to recover from that dissipation, or what capacity? I'm trying to understand what alternatives you have to the this perpetual civil contempt process to address people who dissipate funds and then render themselves essentially somewhat immune from civil contempt because they don't have the ability to pay.
There's criminal contempt proceedings.
That's a one-year sentence. Is there anything is it obstruction of justice? Is there anything like that that can be?
There could be revocation of supervised release. Mm-hmm. It's possible that they could be required to serve their supervised release term.
Okay.
Those are the remedies that I can think of.
Isn't the tricky thing in this case when you say that her telling him that he needs to put together bank records and bring them forward and that's alternative procedures, the tricky thing in this case, which is quite different from the simple situation in Turner, is that here's somebody who there is reason to believe is engaging in further criminal conduct in his failure to comply with the court's order. And so he's really between a rock and a hard place. If he's truthful in showing his inability to pay for counsel, then he's incriminating himself. And that because he's saying, I had these accounts that you found in 2005, I don't have them anymore because I willfully dissipated them. And that is just the kind of situation in which someone would need counsel. It's not a simple situation.
Well, I agree that it would have been better for Mr. Gwynn if he had been willing to listen to the advice of counsel. He got himself into a very difficult spot by disobeying the court's explicit order that he turn these funds over and instead spending them. And I agree by that he got himself in a very difficult spot, but he was unwilling to accept counsel. And the record makes that clear. And the reason he didn't want to accept counsel was because counsel would have told him to stop spending the money, and that would have been something he wasn't willing to tolerate. So if you look at the April hearing, for example, the judge is offering him counsel, and when she brings up the subject of counsel, he changes the subject every time.
And in September at the contempt hearing, it's your position that she offered him counsel?
No, she didn't offer him counsel at the contempt hearing. She had offered him counsel before.
And that carries over? I mean, under Tillman, under the authorities cited, it doesn't carry over from proceeding to proceeding. You can't say, now you've been to mini law school and you don't get warnings. You get warnings at a proceeding in which you're facing time. And that would be the September proceeding. Now, does she engage in any right to counsel colloquy.
There was no right to counsel colloquy at the September proceeding, but he had no right to counsel. The only right to counsel that he's alleged is a right to counsel arising under Turner for an indigent defendant. And he had never suggested that he was indigent, so quite to the contrary.
It's your position that he has to suggest that, that he has to come forward.
Well, he had not only not suggested that he was indigent, he had told her he had $2.5 million that he could pay up. So I don't think the burden's on the district court when you have a defendant before you who says, I have $2.5 million to engage in, with him in a discussion about indigency at that point. Thank you.
Mrs. Stein, you had no time left, but we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Sorry to intrude on your 2 minutes, but I do want to get the record clear on one thing. If the only judgment we're able to review is the 2012 contempt judgment, do you still assert a deprivation of counsel at that proceeding?
Well, yes, Your Honor. First of all, then the court certainly was well aware of claims of indigency at that point. The court had already brought the federal defender in to consult with him, which suggests that it can...
And he had refused the assistance, and the public defender had said, I've left my card with him. In fact, we know he called him back.
With respect, Your Honor, I think that is not an accurate statement of the mm-hmm. record. First of all, Mr. Kramer did not enter his appearance as counsel, only as advisor. Second of all, the only thing they talked about was filing one particular motion, and it's pretty clear on the record that that was a motion where Mr. Kramer was going to claim that Mr. Gwynne was willfully failing to pay.
No. Mr. Kramer was pretty explicit that there were two things that could be argued. One would be it's punitive now, it's willful, and therefore it's punitive. The second one, and he explicitly referenced this in court, was there was also the defense of inability to pay.
Yeah, no, but he did not offer to file a motion on that, and he did not ask for an evidentiary hearing, even though at that point Mr. Gwynne had come forward with certain records. The only thing they talked
sure,
about
he could, I mean, but
this
question
motion,
here is not what the question here is whether at that point Mr. Gwynne was advised that he had a right to counsel and offered counsel.
I don't think that he was. First of all, an advisor is not a counsel. Second of all, Mr. Kramer did not try to advance the argument.
Okay, so just to be clear, your view of what Turner requires is that, in fact, it is not even enough if the district court, as part of a civil contempt proceeding, brings in the federal public defender, has the federal public defender consult with him, ask him if he wants representation, and on record has the individual say, I decline that representation. That's not even sufficient.
No,
Turner
no,
requires
that
more than that?
No, that absolutely is sufficient. What I'm saying is that's not what happened in this case. That is legally sufficient but factually not accurate as a description of this case. He did not decline representation. He declined the filing of one particular motion. And it's always referred to as this motion in the transcript. And we made an offer of proof of it, the court did not inquire into it. We made an offer of proof in our reply brief as to what, or perhaps my original brief, as to what that would have been. And Mr. Kramer does refer specifically to this motion. He does not ask to put on an evidentiary hearing. If Mr. Gwynne had been offered his services to represent him at a hearing to show he did not have a present ability to pay, that he certainly would have accepted that. If I could just say very quickly, because I was answering the mm-hmm. question, I'll make these points very quickly. I submit these are inextricably intertwined under Salazar because it was the same ruling that just kept getting reasserted. The government statement that Mr. Gwynne was not concerned about the civil contempt of 2011 is, of course, completely contrary to the record. As Judge Pillard pointed out in some of her questions, he wrote to the court immediately after returning to prison saying, I have absolutely no money. I did not mean to be disrespectful. One can argue about whether one believes that or not. But in fact, of course, he was disrespectful numerous times to the court, we concede. But he did say, without disrespect, I have no money. And then he went into that long rant about, I have nothing buried. I have nothing in bank accounts. I have nothing in my mattress. I have no money. So he raised that immediately, as soon as he possibly could, after.
And if the district court interpreted that argument as not factual, lack of funds, but instead a repeated assault on the original judgment determination that accounts controlled by his wife and others were ones that he had control over, what would happen then? If that's how we read the district court's interpretation, if that were the interpretation.
If that were, I would say that would be clearly erroneous because the judge never did consider present ability to pay, not at the hearing and not then. All she kept saying is, I found your ability to pay in 2005. Years go by. He has a wife and child, presumably living off whatever resources existed, and there was never a finding about that, which is why there was no she never made a finding about a present ability to pay. She didn't even purport to. What she said repeatedly is the only issue is your willingness to pay. She started out the September 5th, 2007 hearing saying that. And she said repeatedly over the years, I found your ability to pay in 2005, and we're not discussing it anymore. And when he met his burden of production under Rylander to show outlays to the counsel he had at sentencing, to the counsel he had on direct appeal, to things he had spent out of his jail account, she kept saying,
thank you, Ms. Stein.
Not sufficient. And just on your question about alternative remedies, Your Honor, of course, there are also 18 U.S.C. 3614, which allows resentencing after failure to pay, and 3615, which does allow a sentence of a year. Thank you very much.